تخبيش يا سيدي يهودي مسلم نصراني هندوسية الفضوح يا من قلبي من قلبي غمتي ودي.
That's the group Yemen Blues with Min Qalbi. Roughly translated, it means like a heart attack. It's from their 2011 album Yemen Blues, named after the group. This is Lead Stories. I'm Beatrice Lead. It is Tuesday, August the 18th, 2015, and on the program today, Israeli-American peace activist Miko Peled says that Zionism, like apartheid, must be destroyed. Miko Peled was born and raised in Jerusalem. He comes from a privileged family. His father, Mati Peled, was an Israeli army general who helped to orchestrate the attack on Arab armies in the Six-Day War of 1967, when Israel conquered the West Bank, Gaza, Golan Heights, and the Sinai. His recently published book, The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, is a historical narrative of the creation and objectives of the Zionist state, intertwined with the history of his own family in Palestine. We are about to hear a pretty lengthy lecture by Miko Peled, and it was delivered on June the 30th in Berlin. I don't want to interrupt it so that we can hear.
So I always begin my lecture with a little warning. And the warning is that my lecture is completely unbalanced. It is completely one-sided. And if anyone has any strong feelings towards Israel, likes Israel, supports Israel, then this lecture is going to be very difficult for them. And so I like to always say that in advance so people in the audience are prepared. And this issue of Palestine, I think, is a very important issue everywhere, but I think here in Germany particularly, and in many ways in the United States as well, nobody can claim to be neutral. Because both of these countries support Israel so completely. And so much money goes from here to Israel, of course, that everybody is complicit unless they are actively opposing what is happening there. So nobody can be neutral. If we do nothing, if somebody does nothing, then they are supporting Israel and they support what happens in Palestine. If somebody doesn't like it, then they must actively oppose it. And that's not an easy place to be. It's a difficult situation to be in, particularly because the question of Palestine is covered with so many layers of stories and mythology that it's sometimes difficult to find out what the truth is. It's difficult to find out which history is the right history. And it's very easy to get lost. So what I'm going to try to do tonight is perhaps clarify some of the myths, put things in context, because another problem is that the news that we hear from Palestine is always out of context. Suddenly something happens. Suddenly rockets come out of Gaza. Suddenly Israel does something, you know. So there's never context. So to try to put things back in context so that we're clear about the beginning, the middle, and the end of the story. And also another thing I'm going to do is go through the story of my book, which is really the narrative, the story of my journey as an Israeli into Palestine, which geographically and physically is a very short journey, but mentally is an enormous undertaking, or was an enormous undertaking. Now, I'll give you an example of a couple of those myths that make things or seem to cloud the issue. I think probably the biggest one is that Israel is somehow the answer to the Holocaust. And that because of the Holocaust, Israel has license to do whatever it feels like. whatever it wants to do. The Holocaust has given Israel license to act as it will. And that criticizing Israel, not to mention rejecting Israel and rejecting Zionism altogether, which I do, is anti-Semitic. And that there's this connection between criticizing Israel and anti-Semitism, which is really the most disingenuous, dishonest, but very popular idea that's out there. And for many people, it's been a problem to criticize Israel because nobody wants to be called anti-Semitic. And that's one of those myths, you know. Another myth is that we have a choice in terms of the solution. People talk about the one state, two state, as though it's a matter of choice. All we have to do is get together and decide which one we like. And I think it's important to really come to terms with the fact that those are not the choices. The choice is a brutal racist apartheid regime or a democratic regime over the entire country. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. Now, I'd like to pose a question, or another question, and that is, are Israel and Palestine one country or two? And the reason I pose this question is because we hear people say, well, I visited Israel and I visited Palestine. Or this is Israel, something happened here in Israel, and then this has happened in Palestine. We've heard several European countries recognize the state of Palestine. We know that for the last several decades there have been peace talks between Israel and Palestine. We hear that periodically there's a war between Israel and Palestine. So I was born and raised, I lived half my life there, I travel there all the time, I'm there a lot. And my question is, if there is a Palestine that is different from Israel, can somebody tell me where it is? What are the boundaries of this state of Palestine that has been recognized? Who are the population? Who lives in this state of Palestine? What is its capital? Can anybody explain this? Where is the army of this state of Palestine? And of course, none of these questions have an answer. Because this idea that there is a Palestine separate from Israel is a myth. It's not true. A fair description would be that Palestine is occupied. That there's a state of oppression and occupation that exists in Palestine. It's true that Palestine is also called Israel. It's true that there are two nations that live there, Israelis and Palestinians. But the conflict cannot be solved by peace, by peace talks, because the conflict is not one of war. It's a conflict of oppression and occupation. And the way we resolve issues of oppression and occupation is not through peace talks, but it's through a concerted effort to bring about justice and freedom. We don't have two armies, we have one army there, and that's the Israeli army. There are no two governments, there's one government that's in charge of everybody's life, and that's the Israeli government, and there's only one state, and it's the state of Israel, and it governs the entire country. So if these European governments and European parliaments that decided to recognize and to make a statement were to be honest, as opposed to being cowardly, they would recognize that Palestine has been occupied and Palestinians have been oppressed for 67 years. And they would support any effort to bring about freedom and democracy in Palestine. But that's not the case. European governments are totally supportive of the state of Israel, and they did what they did, I believe, as an act of cowardice. Now, people often like to talk about to claim that the beginning of the conflict is thousands of years old. These people over there, they say, have been killing each other for hundreds of years or thousands of years. And therefore, there really can be no solution. Because those people over there are just incapable of getting it together. Which is, of course, a myth And the purpose of this myth is to make sure that none of us look into the source of the conflict, and none of us tries to resolve the conflict. If we were to be honest, I think it would be fair to say that the reason that there exists a conflict in Palestine, it is because of racism and colonialism that were brought to Palestine from Europe. In Israel, they talk about the Balfour Declaration. You may have heard of the Balfour Declaration. And they talk about it, not only in Israel, but all the Zionist organizations and supporters of Israel, talk about the Balfour Declaration as though it was one of the Ten Commandments, as though it was the Word of God, the Balfour Declaration. Every Israeli city almost has a Balfour street. You think Balfour was another prophet. And when you look right at it, the Balfour Declaration, Lord Balfour was the Foreign Secretary of Great Britain, and he made a promise, or gave a promise, a note with a promise, to a Jewish millionaire by the name of Rothschild, saying that the British government agrees to establishing a home for Jewish people in Palestine. Neither one of those two men lived in Palestine or had anything to do with Palestine. And basically we can say that this was one white racist offering another white racist a country that belongs to somebody else. That's what the Balfour Declaration is. Racist colonialist ideas. That came from Europe. Now we move forward several decades, and the United Nations decides to resolve the issue of Palestine through a partition plan. And this is the partition plan. This is the map of the partition resolution. Now, when we look at the map, the first impression that we get is the person who drew this map must have been on drugs or completely drunk. Because how can you possibly create a state or two states with boundaries that look like this? But there's even a more serious problem. This resolution was passed on the 29th of November 1947, which is an important name in Zionist, important date in Zionist history. And again, many Israeli cities have a 29th of November street or a 29th of November plaza or something. At the end of 1947, the entire Jewish community in Palestine was made up of mostly immigrants who were my grandparents' generation, and first-generation Israelis who were born there, like my parents, and numbered about 500,000 people. The local native Palestinian population numbered 3 times as many, about 1.5 million people. Yet in this resolution, the larger portion of the country is given to the smaller Jewish community. And the native population, which is, like I said, basically a community of immigrants who just came off the boat. The native Palestinian community was given, so to speak, the smaller portion. And to this day, people are surprised and say, it's all the Palestinians' fault because they refused the partition resolution. Now, beyond the history lesson here, there's another important thing to remember or to realize. On that day, or from that day on, there emerged 2 opposing narratives, 2 histories that are diametrically opposed, that cannot be bridged. They don't differ in nuance or in detail. They are diametrically opposed. And when we accept one, we have to reject the other. There's no way that the two can live side by side. Now, the Zionist narrative, which is the narrative that I was brought up upon, and the narrative that the West has accepted, says that, or describes the creation of the State of Israel as an act of heroism, the revival of the Jewish people. These people who suffered so much and only several years after the Holocaust returned, accepted the partition resolution, even though because they are descendants of the ancient Hebrews, a tribe that lived there thousands of years ago, the country belongs to them, they accepted the partition. So in other words, they accepted to only take a part of their country. The Arabs attacked them because they're anti-Semitic, and like everybody else, they hate Jews and want to kill them. The Zionists prevailed, and by the end of 1948, the Jewish community in Palestine was able to establish a Jewish state in the land of Israel for the first time after 2,000 years, and only a few short years after the Holocaust. Can you imagine a more heroic, a more romantic story? It seems like it's a new chapter that was written for the Bible. It is so heroic and so romantic. And because it fits well with the religious sentiments and political sentiments and guilt in the West, it has been completely adopted by the West. And how can you argue with a story that is so powerful? Of course, like every story, it has its problems. And about 20 or so years ago, several Israeli historians decided they would look into these problems. Ilan Papig you may have heard of him. He's really the chief historian on this issue, the main historian, the most important one. And of course, they found several things. Probably the most important, or perhaps the one that stands out the most, has to do with the fact that at this time, end of 1947, the Jewish community in Palestine had a very strong armed force, a very strong armed militia. About 40,000 men, well-trained, armed, highly motivated. My father was an officer in that militia, in this armed force. But there was no equivalent on the Palestinian side. There was no Palestinian militia, there was no Palestinian armed force. So who are these Arabs that attack the Jews right after the partition resolution? And what did they attack them with? We know that six, seven months later, other Arab armies tried to intervene in Palestine. They also were defeated quite easily by the Zionist militia. But at that time, at the end of 1947, there was no Palestinian armed militia. There was no possibility for them to attack because they had nothing to attack with. And Ilan Pape and the other historians point out, it was not the Arabs who initiated the attack, but the Zionist militia. After the United Nations gave its support for the establishment of a Jewish state, or so-called Jewish state, in Palestine, they began a massive assault against the civilian population in Palestine in what today can only be called an act of terrorism and ethnic cleansing. And in a matter of 12 months, this attack, this terrorist attack and campaign of ethnic cleansing resulted in the conquering of almost all of Palestine, the destruction of hundreds and hundreds of towns and cities, over 500 towns and cities. Basically, all of Palestine was destroyed, with a few exceptions. And somewhere between 800,000 and 1 million Palestinians were forced into exile. So not so much a story of heroism anymore, more a story of terrorism and horror. And what is interesting is that this is exactly what Palestinians have been saying for decades. But it took an Israeli historian to say this for people to pay attention. Because when Palestinians are saying this, and when Arabs are saying this, we can't believe them because we can't believe Arabs. They're biased, they're liars, and so on. But when an Israeli historian says this, now, especially with a German background, now we can pay attention. And that's exactly what happened. Now, another claim that is made is that, well, even if a few Palestinians were forced into exile and a few villages were destroyed, there was nothing there. We heard about a land without a people. And what few people were there were a few nomads, a few poor farmers. Anything good that was brought to Palestine, any progress that was brought to Palestine, was brought by the Zionists. So I'd like to show these pictures as one example of a Palestinian city before 1948. It's the city of Yaffa. The city of Yaffa was a city of about 120,000 people. with a rich business life, a rich political life, trade unions and writers' guilds. Several newspapers were printed there. Several movie theaters existed there. The famous Jamal Basha concert hall, where some of the biggest names in the Middle East would perform. Beautiful boulevards. And this bustling metropolis of 120,000 people, in the spring of 1948, in a matter of 2 weeks, was reduced to less than 4,000 people, concentrated in a single neighborhood with barbed wires and Israeli guards surrounding them. And on the ruins of Yaffa today sits the Israeli city of Tel Aviv. Now, Tel Aviv, by the way, calls itself Tel Aviv Yaffa, as though an extension into this glorious Jewish past that used to exist there. Jewish past. And there still is a portion of Yaffa that is Palestinian. There still is a Palestinian community in Yaffa. Neglected, harassed, oppressed, subject to racist laws, and constantly harassed by the Israeli security services. And they are Israeli citizens. And beyond the history lesson here also, what's important to remember is this. It is wrong, it is impossible to reduce Palestine into the West Bank and Gaza. Because the entire country is Palestine. Palestinians live in the entire country. Palestinians suffer from the Israeli occupation, Israeli oppression, everywhere they live. There are Palestinians in Yaffa, there are Palestinians in the Galilee. There are Palestinians in Jerusalem, in the Negev Desert, Beersheba. All of these places we have Palestinians living. Some are Israeli citizens, some are less than citizens, some are not citizens. But they are all subject to the racism and the oppression by the state of Israel. And we cannot reduce Palestine to these two small areas of the West Bank and Gaza because the entire country is Palestine. And the life of Palestinians is just as bad regardless of where they live. Now I'd like to take a moment to talk about Gaza. Everything we hear about Gaza is always out of context. Suddenly this happens, suddenly that happens, suddenly terrorism, suddenly Hamas, suddenly rockets, all these things. There's never any context. The Gaza Strip is not a natural area. There's nothing natural about it. It was a line that was drawn by Israel, a region that was established by Israel, in order to house the hundreds of thousands of refugees who were thrown from their homes and off their land during the 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Refugee camps were built around the city of Gaza on the southern coast of the country. A line was drawn. This happened a little bit later on in the early 50s. And the Gaza Strip was created. And laws were passed in Israel that made it illegal for the people of Gaza, the refugees, to ever return. And the attacks on Gaza didn't begin in 2008. Israeli attacks against Gaza began as soon as the Gaza Strip was established in the early 1950s. And in the beginning, the excuse was, or the reason was, that we have a problem of infiltrators. Who are these infiltrators? There's something very dark and mysterious and dangerous about infiltrators. And these were Palestinian refugees who were trying to go back to their homes, back to their land, bring back food, from time to time commit acts of resistance, violence against Israelis. And Israeli units would go in, Israeli commandos would go in and commit terrible acts of violence, massacres, and so forth. Killing, of course, civilians. Later on, they stopped calling them infiltrators, they started calling them fedayeen. Later after that, they started calling them terrorists. Today, they call them Hamas. The name of this monster, the name of this devil that resides in Gaza has changed from, you know, period to period. And the Israeli technology has changed as well. So whereas in the beginning they killed dozens of civilians, last summer, in front of all of our very eyes, in prime time, Israel murdered over 2,000 innocent civilians in Gaza in 51 days. So the technology improves, the name of the devil changes, but the reality is the same. And the question that begs to be asked is why? There's never been a tank in Gaza. There's never been a warplane in Gaza. There's never been a regular army in Gaza. Where's the threat? Why is Israel attacking Gaza for almost 70 years and killing innocent civilians? That is the question that nobody seems to ask. And all we do hear, and we heard this very clearly and very loudly last summer, is all the newscasts, all the news anchors, all the politicians in the West talking about Israel's right to defend itself. There's a list here of statistics, very interesting statistics. I put them up there. I'm not going to repeat them. But the question is why? Where's the threat? Poor refugees, close to 2 million poor, mostly poor refugees living there, are a threat? They never had a tank. Where's the threat? And if you haven't seen what it looks like when Israeli forces come into Gaza, this will give you an idea. This is from early 2009. This is from a little bit closer. And last year, during the assault on Gaza, I was in Palestine, and we drove down to the border just to, you know, see what was happening. And as you approach, especially the southern part of the border with the Gaza Strip, you saw fields lined with this very strange shade of green. And these were tanks. God only knows how many tanks. And you would think Rommel is back. Rommel's armies are back. And they are going to fight them. And of course, besides the tanks, Israel called up 40,000 reservists. And all of this was after 6,000 assaults from the air. 6,000 assaults from the air where millions of tons of bombs were dropped on a civilian population that has nowhere to hide, nowhere to go, no defenses. A one-ton block destroys an entire, a one-ton bomb destroys an entire city block. Now imagine hundreds of those and thousands of those on a civilian population. And they need a committee. They need an inquiry to find out what happened. They just came out with the results. This committee, the UN committee, came out with the results. They need a committee? When you drop tons of bombs on a civilian population, you need a committee to find out if war crimes were committed? How cynical. And again I ask, what was the threat? And I ask, is this really the proper response to the Holocaust? Does the Holocaust justify this? And again, we must ask this question over and over again. Why? What is the threat? And the answer, I believe, is that while there is no threat to Israeli security, certainly there's no existential threat from that perspective, when we look at the Gaza Strip, when we look at the stage of at the state of the refugees, it raises serious questions as to the legitimacy of the state of Israel. This is a threat to the legitimacy. It is a threat to the narrative. The Zionist narrative of 1948 is the Holy Grail. It is the identity of every Israeli, and it is the justification for the existence of the state of Israel. And of course, the proximity to the Holocaust is a big part of that. When we look at the situation in refugee camps, when we look at this catastrophe that Israel has created, there would have been no refugees, there would have been no Gaza Strip, had there not been an ethnic cleansing in 1948. Unless we see the context, we can't understand what is happening, and there's no way, of course, to see a solution. These refugees would be happy to go back to their homes. They don't pose a threat. They do pose a serious question to the legitimacy of the state of Israel and the narrative. So Israel has two choices. It can leave things as they are, But then people will start asking questions. I'm sorry, three choices actually. If they leave things as they are, people are going to start asking questions. What are you going to do? Why is it that a kilometer away from Israeli cities where people live like this, Palestinian kids have to live like this? And of course, these Palestinian kids, their parents or grandparents have homes and land in Israel. That's where they were thrown out of. They'd be happy to go back. And this is not thousands of miles away. This is kilometer, 2 kilometers, sometimes maybe 5 or 10 kilometers away. It's never more than a short drive. So leaving it alone is not an option. Allowing them to return as they deserve to return is not an option either, because Israel doesn't want them back. The only other option is to kill them and blame them for the violence. Attack them and blame them. Attack them and blame them. And it's been a strategy that's worked miraculously. You have to be a magician to pull this off. People watching live as Israeli military murders innocent civilians, thousands of them. And they talk about Israel's right to defend itself? Because the problem is that they dare to resist, they dare to shoot rockets from time to time. Let's see how many of us would survive in Gaza and not shoot rockets. And none of this could have been possible without German money and German weapons. Nobody can say they're neutral. Everybody's complicit unless they actively oppose this. This is the reality here. And every euro that goes to support the state of Israel goes to make things worse, because things will continue and they will get worse. The Palestinian Nakba, the catastrophe, is not something that happened in 1948. It's something that began in 1948. It continues today, and it continues with your support. With tax money. With euros that come from here. Probably more than most other countries. This is something that we have to have ingrained in us. It has to be burned into our souls, into our hearts, because we must act. Now, we hear this interesting theory that the occupation of Palestine began in 1967. If you've been there, or you're from there, I'm sure you've heard this. The occupation of Palestine began in 1967. So, the occupation from 1948 or 1949 to 1967 is what? Disappear? It doesn't count? For the first 20 years of the existence of the State of Israel, almost 80% of Palestine was occupied. In 1967... Israel completed the occupation. Didn't begin the occupation. It finished the occupation. It finished the conquest of the land of Israel, or the conquest of Palestine. And what's interesting also is that we hear that before the war of 1967, Israel was facing an existential threat. Arab armies were once again amassed around the borders in order to kill Jews and destroy the Jewish state. And Israel had no choice but to start the war. And I remember as a child, I was a child there, but I remember the fear, the adults talking. The Arabs are going to come and murder us all. They're going to come and kill us all. If they win, if they come, we're all going to be slaughtered. Which is very interesting. I'd like to show this picture. This is a picture of the Israeli high command. The Israeli military high command. My father was an officer in 1948, like many of these gentlemen, and then remained in the military, and by the 1960s he was a general, he was a member of the Israeli high command. He's in that picture somewhere. Now, as I was working on the book, one of the things that I was able to do was go into the Israeli army archives to learn about his career and so forth, but I wanted particularly to see particular documents, which were the actual minutes of the meetings of these generals leading up to the war of 1967. It was a very interesting time. Now, many people have read them, many people have written about them, but I wanted to see for myself. And even though I wasn't expecting to see anything new, because so much has been written about it, I did see one thing that I had not seen written anywhere. And of course, I mentioned in the book. The Israeli generals, the member of the Israeli High Command, were saying that the Arab armies are not prepared for war. The largest army really was the Egyptian army, the only army of consequence. And they say the Egyptian army will need at least a year and a half to 2 years before they are prepared for war. Therefore, we must attack them now. And then destroy them once again. This will be the third time that Israel destroys the Egyptian army. Not only was there not an existential threat, not a threat at all, but they talk of an opportunity. And they also say that in order to gain popular support, in order to gain the support of the Israeli cabinet, the Israeli government, they must create a sense of terrible fear, that there is an imminent threat, an existential threat. And that's exactly what they did. People thought that God knows what might happen, the Arabs are going to come and slaughter us, the generals knew very well. But the Arabs were not prepared for this, were not able to do this. As it turned out, the war lasted, this war, this horrible threat was wiped out in 5 days. They call it a 6 day war, it was actually over by 5 days. 18,000 Arab soldiers were killed. And 700 Israeli soldiers were killed. Now every soldier that dies is somebody's child, is somebody's son, so of course we cry for all of them. But the difference between 18,000 and 700 tells us where the threat was. Who posed the threat to whom? And when the war was over, these generals congratulated themselves for what they called finishing the job, which is finishing the conquest of the land of Israel. They believed long before 1967 that they should have taken the West Bank. It didn't happen until 1967. But this idea that the occupation of Palestine began in 1967, it's hard to imagine where it came from. I mean, it's not hard to imagine. We know Israel, you know. But I mean, this notion. What happened in between 1948 and 1967? Everything was fine. There was no occupation. Palestine just disappeared. And this is what happened in 1967. They erased Palestine off the map and established a single state over all of Palestine with exclusive rights for Jewish people. Now, they call it a Jewish state. Most Jewish people don't live there. The majority of the people who do live there are not Jewish. Out of 12 million people, 6.1 million are Palestinians. What is Jewish about it? Do they espouse some kind of Jewish values? Like murdering people in Gaza? Like denying children water? Like holding thousands of political prisoners? What exactly is Jewish about Zionism? What exactly is Jewish about the state of Israel? There's nothing Jewish about it, and therefore criticizing it and rejecting it is not anti-Semitism. It's the right thing to do. But they offer exclusive rights to Jewish people. So any Jewish person around the world can land, become a citizen, have all the rights. Palestinians, it's a totally different story. And it's not like this happened in 1967. The very first laws that were passed by the Israeli Knesset in the early 1950s defined the state of Israel as a racist apartheid state by its own definition. The apartheid doesn't exist in the West Bank. The apartheid exists in the entire country. The web of laws under which Palestinians live is impossible to describe. It is so complicated. And the number of laws increases all the time. There is nothing Jewish about the state of Israel. There is nothing anti-Semitic about criticizing and rejecting it. It is the right thing to do for people of conscience. Now, I'll tell you a little bit, an interesting story about my father. This is my father in uniform. And he did something very interesting. As soon as the war was over, the 1967 war was over, the very first meeting of the Israeli Central Command, the Israeli High Command, he stood up and said, "We now have an opportunity to make peace with the Palestinians, to resolve the question, the Palestinian question. We should allow the Palestinians to establish their own independent state in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. If we do this, we will be able to make peace with this country, perhaps make peace with other Arab countries after that, and continue to live as a normal nation, as a normal state." As he was saying these very words, Israeli bulldozers were destroying Palestinian towns, destroying Palestinian neighborhoods, destroying Palestinian communities. Israeli military trucks were taking Palestinians across the Jordan River, forcing them to leave, hundreds of thousands of them, and massive building began for Israeli Jews only in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Exactly what Israel did after 1948 in other parts of Palestine was repeated in the West Bank, because it was not taken in order to one day allow the Palestinians their own state. It was taken to keep. It was taken because it's part of the land of Israel. But he believed that this was an opportunity to solve several problems, and nobody was interested. Nobody was interested. Nobody listened. He retired from the military about a year after that, and for the rest of his life, he continued to pursue this idea that we could have an Israeli-Palestinian peace based on what we call today the two-state solution. Well, that's when the two-state solution was born, as we know it today. And several other Israelis, notable Israelis, joined him. And they began to talk about this. They had their own organization. They spoke about it everywhere. And eventually they were contacted by members of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. Main figures, Yasser Arafat's top people, contacted them to see if there was a way to make this work. And they began a dialogue that lasted many, many years. In the beginning, it was all very secret. In this picture, my father is with Issam Sabtawi, who was the Palestinian ambassador in Paris for many, many years. He was later killed. And what was interesting about these meetings was this. On the Israeli side, these were people like my father. Really, they were renegades. They didn't represent anyone. They had no influence, no power. On the Palestinian side, these were official members of the Palestinian, of the PLO leadership. And the challenge that they faced was to try to convince Yasser Arafat and the rest of the Palestinian leadership to accept this idea, to recognize the state of Israel and change their platform from wanting all of Palestine and this idea of a single democratic state into a small Palestinian state, the two-state solution. And eventually, in 1998, as we know, Yasser Arafat accepted this, recognized the state of Israel, and this process, which they call a peace process, ensued. Now, of course, that turned out to be a catastrophe for the Palestinians. Or I should say, catastrophic for the Palestinians. Now, this is a picture that I like to show you. I'm sure you've all heard of the Oslo Peace Accords, and this is these are the main players, and this is on the way, you know, in the White House to go and sign the Oslo Accords. And when we look at this picture, we see the Egyptian President Mubarak on one side and the Jordanian King Hussein on the other side. Two vicious dictators that nobody ever elected, that are considered friendly and liberal to the West because they're easily corruptible and basically work for Israel. Or worked for Israel. On the Israeli, representing Israel was Yitzhak Rabin, who was probably one of Israel's most notorious war criminals. He later on received the Nobel Peace Prize, where in fact he should have been led to The Hague for war crimes. And they're all led by the American president, and we all know that no American can become president unless they are full supporters of the state of Israel and of Zionism. Nothing good can come out of this group of people. Nothing good. Just by looking at this picture, we can already envision the catastrophe that the Palestinians are being led to. And of course, we know that the Oslo Peace Accord were catastrophic for the Palestinians. And people say that Oslo Peace Accords, that the Oslo process failed. And I would argue that the Oslo process was a terrific success. It did exactly what it was set out to do. Strengthen the Israeli control of the country, the resources, and the people. Kill any chance of this two-state solution ever taking place. Destroy the life, the political existence of a Palestinian national movement. And cause as much fragmentation among Palestinians as possible. And that's exactly what they did. It was a magnificent success. That's what Oslo did. Now, one aspect of this issue that is rarely discussed is the issue of Palestinian prisoners. Today, Israel holds over 6,000 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails in violation of God only knows how many international laws, under conditions that are beyond horrifying. And what's interesting is that they call them terrorists or security threats or security prisoners. But according to Israeli sources, the vast majority of Palestinian prisoners have never been charged with acts of violence. Now, we're talking about the Israeli military court, where the bar is set very, very low. And even the military courts couldn't charge these people with acts of violence. On top of that, we have the administrative prisoners, where these same military courts found nothing with which to charge them, and still they are held indefinitely without charge, hundreds of them. And the pictures I chose here with Samer Issawi, with his sister Shireen. Samer holds the world record for the longest hunger strike in history, over 250 days, something absolutely crazy. He eventually survived, he was released, he went back to prison recently, he went out of prison. His sister is an attorney, she goes in and out of prison all the time. Khadr Adnan, who was held also in administrative detention, had a long hunger strike a couple of years ago. He was recently arrested again, and he just ended 55-day hunger strike. Miraculously, he didn't die again. And what they're demanding is not anything extreme. It's the end of the administrative detention. In other words, if you're going to charge us, you're going to arrest us, charge us with something. That's what they're demanding. And hunger strike is categorically the toughest, hardest sacrifice that anybody could make for any cause. Now, there's a whole other issue that regards this, and that is the fact that the world recognizes the rights of people to resist. The United Nations recognized it and then reaffirmed it. That people who live under oppressive regimes, under occupation, under foreign domination, have the right to resist by all available means, including armed struggle. In other words, there's nothing illegal about the armed struggle. If Israel does not like rockets out of Gaza, Israel has the ability to end the oppression and end the occupation and allow the people of Gaza to live free. But we always, always blame the victim. Now, the world recognizes the rights of people to resist unless they're Palestinians. Then we're up in arms. Then they're terrorists. Then they're not allowed to do this. But the reality is that the Palestinian resistance, most of which has always been unarmed, is not only illegal, it's justified, both legally and morally and every other way. And it's time that we say it, and we say it clearly. And these 6,000, or more than 6,000 prisoners, need to be released. Their voice needs to be heard. Now, another aspect of my own personal story, and this is really probably the thing that led me into activism and doing what I do, because people always ask me, you were raised in such a patriotic Zionist home, such a patriotic Israeli home, how is it you speak the way you do? Well, this is the story. And in September of 1997, my sister's little girl was killed in a suicide attack in Jerusalem. That's her. It's Madar. It was an attack that was ordered and executed by Hamas. And several people were killed, of course. And whenever there's any kind of violence, there's any kind of, that sort of thing, then it's always big news in Israel. This was bigger news because one of the victims was the granddaughter of Batipela, the granddaughter of a famous general, and not only a general, but a general who became known as Mr. Peace of Palestine. I was living in the U.S. already at the time, so I took the first plane home, and when I arrived at my sister's apartment, it was packed with people who came to mourn, both Palestinians and Israelis, and members of the press, hundreds and hundreds in every language, every press agency you can imagine were there. And the questions are always the same. Who's to blame? Who's responsible? How do we punish them? And when my sister, Dorit, finally came out to speak to, to answer questions and talk to people after the funeral, she said a couple of things that were very simple, but in one way, but earth-shattering in another. The first thing she said is, in regards to revenge, retaliation, and then punishment, she said, no real mother would want to see this happen to any other mother. No mother would want to see this grief happen to any other mother. Don't talk to me about killing more people. Don't talk to me about killing people in response to the death of a child. What could be more repugnant than that? And in terms of who's responsible, she said, well, who is responsible for taking Palestinian land, destroying Palestinian homes, shooting Palestinian children, detaining and arresting Palestinians' mothers and fathers, denying Palestinians freedom and water and life. We, the Israelis, are responsible. We have created this reality. When you maintain a brutal oppression and occupation against another nation, this is the price that you pay. And both she and her husband said that they hold the Israeli government directly responsible for their daughter's death. So now this became even bigger news. Now, suddenly, this Israeli mother who just buried her daughter has turned the world upside down because we know that the Arabs, the Palestinians are terrorists and the Israelis are victims. That Israel is a peace-loving nation and wants peace and the Arabs, the Palestinians don't want peace. Then she, all these years, she's gone on to become very outspoken about this issue against Israeli oppression and apartheid regime and so on, as her husband and three other boys. In my case, I went back to the U.S., and you can't just go back and pretend like nothing happened. And I was very fortunate in that in San Diego, where I live, I found what was called a Jewish-Palestinian discussion group, a dialogue group. Now, I was born and raised in Jerusalem. I lived there half my life. The first time I met Palestinians was during these meetings in San Diego in the United States. And the chapter in the book that talks about the beginning of this journey, because that was the beginning of the journey, the first line in the chapter says, my journey into Palestine began in San Diego. I was 39 years old. Now, if you've been to Jerusalem, you know it's supposedly a mixed city. But it's a very racist city. It's a completely segregated city. There is no sphere where Israelis and Palestinians meet. As an Israeli, you live in an entirely different sphere than Palestinians, even though geographically you're very close. So here I was, this Israeli, with this baggage, with this history, sitting among other Jews and Palestinians. And for the first time, I began hearing these stories, this other narrative, this other story that was diametrically opposed to the one I knew was true. And like I said, these are not stories you can bridge. You accept one, you reject the other. And being an Israeli, the Zionist narrative, like I said, it's the Holy Grail. It's who we are. We protect it with everything we've got. But I'm sitting with these people. They're Palestinians. And of course, after a while, you get to know each other and so on. And they're telling me stories about mass expulsions, about massacres, about all kinds of horrible things that could not possibly have been true. Because we don't do this. Our people don't do this. Our soldiers don't do this. It is impossible. So So then I began investigating myself. You know, Papa's books started coming out and others. I began traveling into Palestinian towns, first within what is called Israel, then within the West Bank. I described the first time I actually drove by myself to the West Bank, to the village of Bilayim. It was 2005. I thought for sure that was my last day on earth. There was no way that an Israeli driving alone in the West Bank will not be killed. And this process where you allow trust to come in and it pushes out the fear began. And it's a very long, it's actually a very painful process. But the more you allow trust to come in, the quicker it pushes out the fear.